This is the Horse Radio Network.
What a beautiful day for horses in the morning.
Well, good Thursday morning, everybody. I am Glenn the Geek from Ocala, Florida.
And I'm Mary Kitzmiller from Kemp, Texas, and you are listening to Horses in the Morning on the Horse Radio Network for November 10th, episode 1563. Today's show is brought to you by Horseware. Good morning, Horse World.
Well, happy birthday to the United States Marine Corps. It's their birthday today. My dad was a Marine, and this was his favorite version of the Marine Corps hymn. So happy birthday to all the Marines out there today. My dad was a Marine for 4 years during the Korean War. He went in the 1950s and was drafted, I think. Went in the 1950s and, you know, the Korean War was rather nasty. A lot of soldiers were dying. So, you know, nobody was thrilled about having to head over to Korea. And his unit, during training camp, he was assigned to a unit. Well, Mary, he had flat feet. So they didn't send him with his unit. Instead, he could shoot really well. He had won all kinds of marksmanship awards. So they kept him at Parris Island for 4 years, training guys how to shoot guns. That's what he did for the whole 4 years. And then he found out, he was really relieved that he didn't have to go to war. But then he found out that his unit ended up being MPs in Southern Florida and spent most of their time on the beach. So,
oh man.
So his unit didn't do too bad anyway, but yeah.
If he'd just gotten arch supports,
that's right.
That might have saved him.
Can you imagine back then? Flat feet kept you out. You know, it's just.
You know, though, I have flat feet and I can relate.
So that was my dad's story, and we miss him every day. And I know he was very proud of his Marine Corps time. I posted a picture of him on my Facebook page today so that people could see my dad in uniform. And actually, my brother sent me pictures I had never seen before of the time he was at Parris Island with all his friends.
Oh wow!
Yeah, so it was kind of cool to see those pictures for the first time too. Your whole family's military.
Yeah, and you know, listening to that song, I had a CD as a kid with a bunch of military marches, so it brings memories back. I like that kind of music. You know, it's got that, 60 beats per minute, kind mm-hmm. of matches your heart rate, so you can't help when you're listening to it, you get all pumped up. But yeah, I don't have any Marines, but a lot of my family's military. My grandpa fought in World War II with the Army. He actually had an interaction with General Patton.
Oh, really? What, was it good?
It was interesting. Okay,
I can't. Did he get slapped, did he?
No, but okay, he was an officer. I'm going to get some of the details of this wrong. He was an officer, and I think the officers, they were in Germany, and I don't know what was going on at the moment, but some of the officers were putting mud over their bars or something so that they couldn't be distinguishable as officers. And Patton walked by and he said, you know, knock that off, take that off. and there's also another kind of cool story. My last name is Kitzmiller. And when he was marching in Germany, he came across an overturned sign in the mud, and it was for a town called Kitzmüller, which was pretty cool.
Oh, wow.
And then, you know, my dad is Air Force, and my stepdad is actually over in Baghdad right now. He was Air Force for many years as a civilian, and he's running the Baghdad airport. And my mom was Air Force, my uncle was Navy, and my brother is Army and just started Ranger School here a couple days ago.
Oh, wow.
That's and I guess Ranger School in the winter. He's just a couple years younger than me. So he's, is he 31 or 32 now?
Is that old to be starting Ranger School, or is that about the age? Because they're always in for a while before they head off to the Rangers usually.
You know, I don't know. And this isn't his first time to do it. The last time, I think he hurt his leg. He got injured and he couldn't keep going. So he's trying again. He's done a lot of cool stuff in the Army. He's been to both. He's been to Afghanistan and Iraq, but he was in the old guard for a while. And those are the guys. They do the 21 gun salute at presidential funerals. And old guard are the guys who guard the tomb of the unknown soldier. He didn't guard the tomb, but I think he was up for that. I think that was something he considered doing.
You just got to be really good at standing still for a lot of time.
That there's all sorts of stuff.
And being comfortable in your own thoughts. I would never be able to do it.
I could do that. I'm such an introvert. I could sit in my room staring at the wall for hours and have the time of my life.
Why are you doing a radio show anyway?
Because I don't have to be in a room with actual people. It's perfect.
Got it. Got it. That's fun. That's funny. So we want to say give our best to all the servicemen out there, but especially the Marines on their, I think it's 231, the 231st birthday. We have a show to do, though, Mary, of course, is here the second Thursday of every month talking about training horses, and we always get lots of questions from the listeners, and Jennifer's going to tell us what else is coming up on today's show.
Coming up on today's Horseware Training with Mary Kitzmiller, Samantha Reed is going to stop by, and she's going to give us an update on her Extreme Mustang Makeover horse and see what kind of progress they're making coming up to their competition. And after the break, Mary's going to answer all of the training questions you were not afraid to ask. So stay tuned for the fray, folks.
And there's some interesting ones today. So some we get the same questions almost every month. I think what happens is the question's worded in a different way, and people hear your answer one month, but it doesn't quite fit their situation. So that's why it always comes in a little different way. Now, you are training a bunch of horses, so tell us, get us caught up on what's going on. Well, not just horses. You're training a bunch of four-legged animals. Tell us what's going on with the four-legged animals. Oh, did we lose Mary?
Oh, no.
There she is.
Mary left the room. There's Mary.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, there you go.
Okay. It always does this halfway through the show. So, yeah, I've got a mess of animals that I'm working on. I know a few people have asked about Moonshine, who was a horse I was going to compete at the Thoroughbred Makeover. He's still doing good. He's still fine. The reason I did decide to withdraw, he had some white line disease several months before the competition, and my farrier kind of resected some hoof wall, and that normally doesn't cause lameness, but afterwards he just had intermittent lameness, so much throughout that I thought I'm not going to be able to catch up on training. It'd just be better to withdraw him. So he's going to be fine. Just got to let his hoof grow, nice, healthy foot grow out. So I still have him. I'm keeping him. I'm going to train him, make sure he's a really nice and awesome horse, which he is. And I'll probably think about reselling him at some point to, a good home. And then I've got a Mustang for the Mustang Magic competition. Her name is Winter. So her tagline is Winter is coming. Ha ha ha. I've got a mess of other project ponies. I've got a few striped
goat
horses I'm
How's
working with. Oh, the goat.
I don't know how the goat is. Goat
world's is... most, what is it? The world's most handsome goat?
Interesting goat.
Interesting goat.
Most interesting goat.
He has nearly 500 followers on Facebook without even trying.
What's the Facebook page again?
The world's most interesting goat. And I need to update it. I've been a little bit behind on posting interesting goat posts.
You know, he is the biggest ham of a goat I've ever seen.
And me too.
He just doesn't stop. That's funny.
Yeah, he's very special. I have another goat who's a very regal goat who is very friendly, but just kind of is off in his own little world. But this goat, and I've never really settled on a name for him. We just call him Baby Goat. He's like a dog. He greets everybody who drives in the driveway. And we found out yesterday he loves Cheetos. So there's that. And when we're not outside, you know, when we're outside, he hangs out like a dog. And when I'm inside, he's on my chair on the porch, just hanging out, waiting for me to come back out.
You have a friend for life there.
Yes.
Were training a zebra too. That was new in for training. How's that going?
Pretty good. He's a little guy I'm clicker training. So mainly we're working on don't run away. And then we'll build from there. That seems to be a trend with zebra hybrids.
They just are slow to learn?
No, actually incredibly, incredibly smart. Okay. But the two that I have are very protective of themselves, strong survival instinct. And they pick up on things way quicker than horses do as far as there's a threat in the distance. And I'm like, that's a cow 2 miles away in a pasture behind two lines of fencing. They're like, no, I need to be on high alert. I'm like, no, you'll be okay. It's just a cow.
That's funny.
Yes.
So now you have, we're going to be talking a little later about the Mustang Magic, and that you're competing in Mustang Magic as well. And you mentioned that horse. Have you started? What's your goal for that particular horse? And what's the horse's name again?
Her name is Winter.
Winter. So that's right. That's yes. Winter is coming. So yes. Is Winter is coming started training?
Yes. So the pickup date for these guys was like September 23rd or something. And I happened to be in Washington during that time. I was there till like first week in October. So a friend actually picked her up for me, and I didn't just want her sitting wild for 3 weeks. So I said, you know, hey, can you just do a little gentling? Because she's really experienced with Mustangs herself. So she got her leading around with the halter and going over obstacles, and she put a saddle on her. And but the horse is still, she's very, very sweet. She's one of the sweetest Mustangs ever, but very, very fearful. So I've been doing a lot of clicker training with her, which, you know, I find is really awesome to kind of rewire a horse that's real timid and fearful, that you just can't seem to get him to stop being so scared of things. So she's doing really well. She's really turned a corner. She's doing a lot of cool things. And so she will, we will compete at the end of January at the Fort Worth Stock Show. And they've got to do, you know, like a kind of a reining pattern. You have to do a handling and conditioning class where you show that you can lead the horse around and load it in a trailer and catch it and pick up its feet. And I there's a trail class and then freestyle.
Very cool. So, well, we'll look
to do a lot of stuff.
Yeah, you have to do a lot of stuff with a horse that's been trained for how long?
Like 4 months.
4 months. So that's pretty good. Well, you are also every month you do a training tip here on the show. And what are we talking about this month?
So actually it goes perfectly in hand with what I've been doing with Winter. So, teaching your horse to lower his head, and it's the ultimate calm down cue, which I've definitely seen as of late with my Mustang. So a lot of people know that teaching a horse to lower its head, helps calm the horse down. And even if you don't, that's cool too. So, you know, there's a lot of horsemanship programs that teach you to teach a horse to lower, to pull pressure. You know, if you put your hands behind their ears and gently press, teach them to lower their head. And you use it for haltering your horse, getting a bridle on them. And then, you know, it also just has a natural calming effect on the horse. I don't know if it releases endorphins or dopamine, or I don't know what the magic is behind it. And I had a cow horse trainer tell me one time that, if you have a horse lower his head, like when you're riding, you ask him to lower his head to the ground, that it gives him a chance. It gives a chance for all the marbles to roll back in their head. And that's a perfect analogy because it's pretty much exactly right. You'll see if you watch, reining patterns, NRHA reining, that, a lot of those guys will have the horse lower their head, in the reining pattern. And that's because, you know, like in the middle of the reining pattern, the horse is asked to do a lot. They might either, you know, in the middle of the arena, for NRHA reining, the horse might either be asked to do lead change. They might ask to spin really fast to the right or really fast to the left. They might be asked to speed up or slow down. So there's a lot of stuff that could happen in the center of the arena, and those horses can get pretty nervous about it in anticipation of, you know, are we going to change leads? Are we going to go faster, slower? Am I going to stop? Am I going to spin? And so a lot of reiners that I know have adopted the habit of having the horse do a maneuver like a turnaround, a spin, and then they will stop the horse, and in between maneuvers, they'll ask the horse to lower its head. And it's sort of like hitting the reset button, and you're giving the horse a job to do, so that they can focus on that instead of worrying about the next thing that's coming. And that's kind of similar to what I've been doing with my Mustang. Is she was very timid, very fearful. With winter, she wants to bolt forward all the time. So I did a lot of walking a few steps and stopping and asking her to stop and stand and wait till I ask her to go again, which is very difficult for her. She wants to shoot forward. If anything makes a noise, she wants to bolt. She doesn't like standing still for long periods of time. It stresses her out. And so the head lowering, it was something that I did with her to give her something else to do. So sometimes asking your horse simply to stand still is a little too abstract for them. They can't wrap their mind around it. They don't want to stand still. They want to move. They think you're going to ask them to go again. So they're anticipating that. So by asking her not only to stop, but to lower her head, it just gave her something else to focus on. And so I trained that. I actually train it out of teaching them to back. So I teach a horse to back off of gentle halter pressure. And the more free you get their feet in the backup, what will naturally start to happen is their pole will drop. So I like teaching it that way because it keeps me from having to press too hard on their pole or pull too hard on their face. I don't want to make them feel that uncomfortable when asking them to lower their head. And of course, I use the clicker, so I have the marker signal. So when I was backing her up, every time her head would drop, I would click. And then eventually, I would just pick up the halter and she would immediately lower her head. So I just took the backup out of the equation and we worked on lowering her head. And so I have used it to the extreme with this horse. We do it both at the walk, trot, and we do it at the walk, trot, and canter. I ask her every time she stops, I ask her to lower her head. And because I've reinforced it so much, now it's something that's almost becoming a default behavior. Anytime she's unsure, she lowers her head, which is because before, when she was unsure, she would run off. And so giving her something that's a very safe behavior that, you know, hey, if you're not sure what to do, just lower your head, has made a huge change in the horse.
Very cool. Well, you know, going along with that, we have time, I think, for a listener question. And, you know, when you talk about what, when you mentioned about not forcing the issue, Radley, one of our listeners, asked, I always wonder about collecting the horses I train. Sometimes I feel like I'm pulling on their faces too much. And I'm wondering if you have a good exercise for that.
I have like 17 good exercises for that.
So, well, maybe do a couple.
Yeah. So, yeah, that is actually pretty common. And I've dealt with it myself of feeling like I'm pulling too much or, man, I think I need to go get a bigger bit because this horse, you know, I just feel like I'm hauling on their face and I don't want to do that. So, first of all, as you know, you may know, collection is not about pulling them back into collection. It's very much about forward. You want to ride them into your hands. So if you feel like you're pulling back too much, there needs to be a change that happens there. Now, if you ride them forward into your hands, you know, you drive the horse forward and ask him to go forward into that frame, and he ends up just blowing through the bridle, instead of just pulling back on him for hours in the ride, what I would recommend doing, and this is kind of a big secret for me in getting a soft frame on my horse, is work a lot on downward transitions. So for a horse to go forward in collection, or for them to go into an upward transition in collection, to me, in the beginning, that's pretty difficult. So I will ask the horse first to soften in downward transitions. So I know I said you're riding the horse forward into your hands. I still think of downward transitions as a forward movement. If my horse is on his front end, he's not going to come down into a downward transition really well at all. It's going to be very jerky. He'll throw his head up. And you really see that when you're working on sliding stops in the reining. If the horse is unbalanced, he can't get down in the ground and slide. He will, you know, pogo stick you right out of the saddle. So I, you know, you could start this at a walk and go from the walk to a soft stop and even a soft backup. So I'll work on my downward transitions until I can pick up on the horse and they immediately stop their feet or slow their feet into, you know, the slower gait, and they soften their face. And if they can get that, that's almost a foundation for a half halt if you're thinking dressage. Especially if you're doing a downward transition from, say, a canter to a trot, because you want the horse to slow his feet, but you don't want him to stop moving forward. So you've got to at the same time, you've got to ask the horse to come down, slow down, soften. But if he does that too much, or if like all the gas comes out of the engine and he just hits the dirt, it's not going to be nice. So as you ask him to slow down, you have to keep just enough leg on him to maintain the gait you're asking him to transition to, if that makes any sense. So I work a lot on downward transitions. I work on walk to halt. I work on trot to walk, canter to trot. But then also I'll work on a working trot to maybe like a Western type jog, or an extended walk down to a working walk, or a canter to an extended trot to a working trot to a jog. So within each gait, and I've talked about this a lot before, but it's really important. It's an important thing for me. I really like talking about this. Those transitions are going to help you out so much, especially the downward transitions. If you feel like you're pulling on your horse, I usually ask for a downward transition. So if I am riding my horse at the trot and I just feel like they're pulling my arms out of my socket, I will ask them to slow down, maybe even come to a complete stop and soften. And I might even ask for a backup. And I wait to release in that backup until they're very light on their feet, they're light in my hands. And then when I get that feeling, I usually stop, let the horse have a little break, and then we go on again. So if I can't get a soft downward transition, then actually getting softness in the gait is not going to work. So I get those transitions really good to where that horse just is really nice and responsive. And then I'll start worrying about, okay, can you hold that softness in the trot for more than a few strides? And I'll build from there. And only after I get all of that will I even think about asking the horse to soften into an upward transition.
Got it. All right. Do you want to do another one here quick before Jennifer's
sure,
going to be in our
it.
Guest on the line here shortly. So let's see. Well, one we have tackled before, and Jennifer just tackled with her horse, Nigel, and that is from Jerry. He says, I posted this. He says, both boys stand very well until it's time to mount. They time it so just as you're starting to get on, they will take a step or two away from the mounting block and laugh at me. No, I added that part. any suggestions? I think they are laughing at you. But I happen to know that I think one of his horses anyway is a draft horse.
Oh yes, so that's important.
Yeah, you don't want to miss.
Yes, exactly. You know, people get so hung up on the mounting block, and I totally understand why. And I almost feel like I should do an entire clinic on mounting block.
You probably could sell it out.
The reason I say that is not because I think, oh gosh, you guys, you can't even get yours to stand up to the mounting block. It's not that, but because there's so much you can get done with training your horse to stand at the mounting block. It makes an enormous change in your horse. And I've only just started playing with it in the last few years of teaching colts to either come up to the fence to pick me up or come up to a mounting block. And I learned a lot about horses working on these exercises. Initially, I really started working on it for colts. I was starting because it was just one extra thing I could do before I get on. They can see me at a different angle. I can simulate, you know, getting on their back. I can hang over them. And it's a great prep work for your first ride. And I also had the same experience where, you know, I finally get them to come up to the mounting block. And then I say, okay, it's time to ride. And I twist the stirrup to put my foot in, and they take a step away. So what we tended to do and what I tended to do was I might kind of hastily fix it and then get on. Or I might just say, you know what? That's only 3 feet away from the mounting block. I think I can jump and make it. And then, you know,
how's that go? Try,
yay, it's not so good. But, you know, your horse takes a step away and you're like, ah, I'm going to get on, you know. And because when we get our horses out, most of the time we're thinking about riding and what all we're going to do when we ride. And so if they take a step away from the mounting block, but I kind of think I can still make it, I'll just get on, or I would just get on. And, you know, then pretty soon it would become more of a chronic habit or problem. And now, okay, I've got a real issue. So to me, having a horse that you can't get to the mounting block, or that will move away from the mounting block, or will move away from the mounting block at the last possible second, clearly demonstrates I need to gain more control of their feet. And so instead of getting frustrated and thinking, well, darn it, I wanted to ride, and why is my horse doing this, and he's being a trickster, I look at it as a really good opportunity. Okay, well, that's clearly some area that I didn't have great control of your feet. So let's work on it. So I've been known to sit out there for a half an hour and get the horse to line up to the mounting block, and I'll simulate getting on, like, okay, I'm going to put my foot in the stirrup. And if they step away, I don't punish. I don't like run them around in circles and put them back over there, because most of the time, if your horse is stepping away at the last possible second, they're not being silly. They're not trying to one-up you. There might be some anxiety there, you know, just a tiny bit of anxiety. And if I see my horse stepping away from me when I get on as a personal affront and I punish them for it, I'm not going to do anything but make that anxiety grow. So now they're going to look at the mounting block as, oh my God, that's that thing where we have to run around for 20 minutes and, you know, my owner gets really frustrated. And so then they'll really not want to go near the mounting block. So I matter of fact about it, you take a step away, I'll ask you to take a step back. And then they take a step away and I make them take a step back. And we might do that back and forth for half an hour. And I don't change anything. I just say, okay, put a step back. And sometimes I'll be very specific in teaching my horse how to take a step toward me with their hips, and I'll put a cue to it so it's quite easy. And sometimes we're just not at that stage of training, and I'll just see what I can do with my tools I've already put on my horse to get them to take a step back. And it might be a while before, okay, I need to move your shoulder here and get you to back up a couple steps and line you back up. But all of that to me is really worth going through, because you just gain more control of their feet. That's all that's happening. Which, even though you're not riding, you might not feel like you're getting anything done. You really are. I guarantee if you worked on mounting block behavior to perfection, your rides will get better. Again, like I said, if they take a step away, I do whatever I can with the tools and buttons I've put on my horse to get him to take a step back. And then I'll say, okay, I'm going to get on now. You know, I'll pull on the saddle horn or twist the stirrup like I'm going to get on, lift my leg. And if they take a step away, I put them back. And we'll go back and forth and back and forth and back and forth and back and forth for however long it takes. I don't care. I've got all day. Or I act like I've got all day. And then what usually happens at the end of all that is that horse will just go, take a big sigh, and they will take a step back toward the mounting block, and then they will stay there indefinitely. And it takes a while. Sometimes you go through it for a long time. If it is something like that where I've worked on it for half an hour and the horse finally gave me an inch and stayed still at the mounting block, I might get on, sit on them, scratch their neck, give them a cookie, and then put them away for the day. Now, maybe I walked out there with the intention of, we're going to work on our lead changes today, and we're going to do our sliding stops, and I'm going to take off the bridle and ride around and jump over fire, and we got stuck on the mounting block for half an hour. I don't care. You know, to me, if your horse had that issue and you spent a lot of time working through it and they finally let down, trusted you, did that for you, I don't think whatever you did under saddle would be any better. So put them away, even if it's just for a little while. Come back later and do it again. And you'll find that that really will go a long way. And if you get things like mounting block behavior really good, like I said, I guarantee you your ride will get better because all you're working on is controlling their feet. So it's just another way to get control of their feet. So I hope that helps.
There you go. Cool. I noticed that with Nigel, you touched on the anxiety issue. One of the contributing factors for him was, just that, in that he was anticipating going out and having to do work in the arena, which he was not particularly comfortable with physically, in that he, you know, had sore spots and stuff like that. So he anticipated that. So that showed up when he had to stand still at the mounting block. He's like, no, let's just get this over with. And as I started to reduce that anxiety, he didn't anticipate going in the ring and doing things that that made him physically uncomfortable. That reduced a lot. And then the other thing, again, that you already mentioned that I did with him was to set aside my agenda for the day. If it took 15 minutes and three times getting on and off of him to get it figured out for that day, that was fine. Just set all the other stuff up aside. I really didn't need to work on shouldering today that badly. Just one step at a time here. And over a period of about a month and a half, got worked out. And now I can just walk him over there to the mounting block, hop up on there. We hang out, we stand around, we watch the world go by, and then we walk off. You know, you everything that I did, you just explained.
Awesome. Cool. So you did it right.
Mary, got it right.
and you brought up such a good point about setting aside your agenda. And that's almost all horse training is. We get our, you know, we get our plan working, you know, like, okay, today is the day I'm going to jump that 6-foot jump. And then your horse doesn't stand tied for grooming that day. And if you kind of gloss over that and say, yeah, I don't care about that. We got to do the jump that we're going to do. And it's not going to go as well, because to me, things like that, those little things that annoy us and they seem inconsequential, are clear signs I don't have the precision I need in terms of controlling their feet. So even though
they're all contributing factors, aren't they?
Exactly. Yeah. So even though, let's say I came out and I'm like, we're going to do, you know, 50 tempi lead changes today. We're ready. I'm all excited about it. And my horse won't stand at the mounting block. So I spend a half hour working on it. I find a good place to stop. I don't feel like I should get on and then ride for an hour. And I may feel like I didn't get done what I wanted to do today. You absolutely worked on your tempi lead changes that day, because though that maneuver requires such a degree of precision and control of their feet, that working on things like the mounting block, which actually I do a lot of hip work with that, take a step over here with your hip, now step away, now back up a step. Don't run forward. Don't run sideways. That's all things that I would have been working on in my lead changes. And so, again, you work on something like that, that doesn't seem like you've gotten much done. I guarantee when you do put your foot in the stirrup and you get on, your ride will be better.
All right, guys, let's. Where our first guest is coming up, but first we have to hear a short message from our sponsor, Horseware, about their terrific Ice Vibe product. And then coming up, we have Samantha Reed, who's competing in the Mustang Magic competition as well. one of your competitors. Are you going to try and get the dirt on what she's going to do to beat you?
Yeah, okay. Yes, that was my master plan.
In the world of horse racing and elite equestrian sports, it's all about how to prepare and repair. IceVibe is a truly portable and highly efficient circulation therapy system for your horse. Before activity, prepare to prevent damage by using the IceVibe's vibration pads. Repair after the event by using the unique combination of cold packs and vibration to minimize swelling and encourage blood flow. And because it's battery-powered, IceVibe is truly portable, the essential and affordable tool to prepare and repair. IceVibe.
You can find out more details about IceVibe at ice-vibe.com or horseware.com, or ask your local tack shop or online supplier for more information about IceVibe circulation therapy from Horseware.
Okay, so we have with us today one of the competitors in the Mustang Magic competition, and this is a competition that is a branch of the very popular Extreme Mustang Makeover. So we have with us Samantha Reed, who is a competitor. How are you, Samantha?
Good morning. I'm doing well. How are you?
Good, good. So how is your Mustang doing?
Oh, she's doing pretty well. She's been a little bit challenging, if I'm being honest. But overall, I'm real happy with her, and I think she's going to make somebody a really nice horse.
Awesome. And so, you know, a lot of people know about the Extreme Mustang Makeover. It's the big one that takes place in September. There's been a movie about it. There's been a TV show about it. But a lot of people don't know that they actually have several competitions every year. And one of them is the Mustang Magic, which also takes place in Fort Worth, Texas. But that one is a little bit different. Can you tell us what sets that one apart from your typical Mustang Makeover?
Yeah, the Mustang Magic, first of all, it takes place during the Fort Worth Stock Show and Rodeo. So that in itself, I think,
so there's no distraction then. It's nice and quiet. There's nobody around.
Exactly.
There's no bucking broncos.
Exactly.
Nothing of that stuff. She's like,
you know, that's
crazy enough to make your job any harder.
Exactly.
Yeah, that is my secret weapon, is a lot of horses, and not just Mustangs, a lot of seasoned show horses will go to the stock show and lose their minds because you've got alpacas and mini horses pulling carts and mini donkeys, and there's a mule show and all sorts of commotion. And
can we mention the drunks? There's lots of those. There's a lot of alcohol consumed
yes.
there.
Well, drunks aside, I have all that at my ranch. So my horses look at the mini donkeys and they're like, oh yeah, my friend Bob looks like you, so we're cool.
Do you go down to the local bar and bring them back and say, I want you to be drunk around my horses here. Carry on.
Or I'll just take some Fireball out with me and we're good.
Sorry, Samantha. Go ahead.
No, that's okay. That was great. So that in itself makes it a little bit unique and a little bit special, I think. But also, the Mustang Magic is invitational. So, you know, the Mustang Heritage Foundation, they host all these different makeovers throughout the year. And they have a list of their top 10 at each makeover. And so if you've placed within the top 10, you're on their list to potentially be invited to the Mustang Magic during the Fort Worth Stock Show in January. So that makes it also a little bit different. It's not just sign up and, hey, I'd like to train a Mustang for a makeover. They select their trainers for this makeover.
So this is invite only, best of the best. I'm not sure how I got in, but I will take it.
I'm not sure how I got in either, but I'll take it too.
And then, you know, I also notice, I think the sale for this is always really good because, you know, again, it is during the stock show. They pack the arena. They've had the fire marshal actually have to come in and clear people out before. So the sale of these horses that get adopted out after the adoption, after the competition, is always pretty good. And so in the last few years especially, they've really made it a point to pick just these gorgeous Mustangs. They're so colorful. They pick a lot of color. You know, there's a lot of, this year I've seen a lot of beautiful bays and palominos, and I've got a really pretty gray horse. So it's pretty neat in that aspect, and just a really, really pretty cool atmosphere. I'm really excited to be competing. So you say your mare has been a bit of a challenge. Do you know anything about like where she came from when she was gathered?
Yes, she is out of Jackson Mountains, Nevada. And she was, I think she's a 2010 model, but she was gathered in 2012. If I remember her paperwork correctly. She's a little bitty thing. She's a little bay and a couple white socks and a star and a little snip on her nose. I call her Clementine. But she, you know, she's been a little bit of a challenge in the sense that she's got a little bit of an independent mind about her. She's very cautious. She hasn't been one to just quickly, be my friend. But she's made a lot of progress and she's becoming, quite a little sweetheart. And, I'm getting really excited about this little horse. She's a quick learner and, I'm really enjoying this process with her.
I got to tell you, the Jackson Mountains, I've got a special sentimental feeling for that HMA because my two best Mustangs came from there. So maybe that's a good sign.
Oh, great.
And
This is my first one from this HMA. So I didn't know much about them. So that's really interesting.
Yeah, the two I got two geldings. My 2012 horse, the one I got fourth on, also a little bitty bay who, he's very sweet. He kind of rides like a dairy goat, but I still have him and I love him and he's adorable. And, you know, him, he was pretty, they were both pretty great to get along with. The other one was my Mustang Million horse. And I swear they were brothers. I mean, that particular HMA is huge. And someone told me that if you were to drive across it and look at the horses, they'd go from very, very big giraffe size horses to very, very tiny. And I think you probably are like me and we got the tiny end of that herd or that HMA.
I'm glad for the small.
Yes. That's always very nice. Very nice. So have you ridden her yet? What's the training been like with her? Do you have any special tricks up your sleeve when you're training your Mustangs? Anything you really like to get done?
Yes, I have probably about 30 rides on her now. As far as tricks up my sleeve, you know, I kind of just take it one day at a time. I don't treat each Mustang the same. They're different. They learn different, just like, you know, we as humans learn different, and you can't treat one like the other at all the time. They learn at different speeds. They learn in different ways. And, you know, it's a constant learning process for me. And, I'm learning from them and I'm learning from other people. And each session, I just, try to take my time and do things slow and right. Rather than let the pressure of, oh my gosh, I only have a little over 3 months and I have to get ready for competition. And at times, you know, that thought kind of wants to sink in and you want to get stressed out about it. But, you know, I just one day at a time, one step at a time, I try not to skip steps. If you skip steps, you end up having to go back later, and fix something that you shouldn't have maybe needed to fix because you could have, you know, prevented it from happening in the beginning. But, this little girl, she's been real sticky on the ground. She's kind of hard to get moving forward in her groundwork, but once you get her under saddle, she's actually pretty, pretty soft and pretty feely. And like I said before, she's just a super fast learner. So she's made that aspect of things a little bit easy, but it's the building of her confidence in what I'm asking her to do. You know, it's kind of turned into, well, I'm going to do it because I know it's what I'm supposed to do, but I'm not really sure this is okay at, you know, 100%. So I've been spending just a lot of time trying to do things slow and right.
You know, that last part you said, it actually reminds me of my little Mustang. It's kind of really interesting because she's one of the more fearful ones I've had. She's not an outlaw. Like, she's very sweet, but I've never had a horse try so hard to do what they think is the right thing while being so scared at the same time. It's really interesting. And that's been a big challenge, is trying to, you know, I don't just want her to go through the motions and do what I ask. I mean, that's very nice, but I want it to come from a place where she's relaxed and hopefully even enjoys what she's doing. And that's a tricky thing. And, you know, with these Mustangs, people kind of think that it's like getting a quarter horse, or, you know, and even in quarter horses, they're all so different, but they think that all Mustangs are going to go a certain way. Or, and, you know, people ask me questions like, yeah, but don't Mustangs always do this, or don't, you know, aren't they always like that? And like you said, I've never had to change my program up so much than we're working with these Mustangs, because they're so different and their challenges are very different. You know, and whatever you want in a horse, you could probably find a Mustang that matches those traits. You want a slow, calm trail horse. In fact, I have one of those. You can find a Mustang for that. You know, you want something that's really fast and can do speed events. You can definitely find it. It'll be tricky, but you could find a Mustang for everything that you want in a horse.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I agree. And, yeah, you just, I had this little girl's teeth floated. When I first got her, she had her about a week, and she had what I thought was going to be an abscess tooth. A lump showed up on her side of her face. And, turns out her teeth were so bad, she just chewed a hole in the side of her face and created a sore that ruptured, bless her heart. And the vet that came out to work on her for me, he said, oh yeah, I dealt with, you know, a few Mustangs. He said, you can't treat them like a regular horse. You won't get anything done. He said, they're very different, and you just have to, you know, take your time and you'll get it done in a hurry. But if you try to get in a hurry, you'll be here all day and you may not get anything done. And I said, yes, sir, you're absolutely right. And he was very, very good with her. And it really hit home with it when he said, yeah, you can't treat them like a regular horse or you won't get anything done. And it's absolutely true. They're very different. They have a stronger instinct about them than your domesticated horses. And I think that's one of the things that's interesting about even training these guys, is it's kind of learning, you know, what their natural instincts are when they're out in the wild and they feel afraid for their life. And it's very different than your colts that you raise yourself or you go buy from somebody else that's raised them. And I find too, I don't know about you, Mary, but humans become a huge obstacle for me. They bond with one human, but they don't realize that all humans are also not horse eating humans. And so I find that new people are often an obstacle within itself. And that's been a very interesting thing to learn about these horses.
Yeah, Mary's that way too, by the way.
I almost forget about.
I was just going to say, Mary, you're that way too about new humans. It's the same thing.
I'm very timid, you know, with new people. And everyone wants to hug me. Don't hug me.
I'll remember that at the show.
Yeah, I remember that. Okay, January. Yeah, I made the mistake.
Run up
that mistake
and give Mary
too.
A great big hug because she loves them.
I made people that mistake too.
People who like to hug see it as their mission in life to hug people who don't prefer hugs. And yes, that's like a special challenge.
Jennifer's that way too. She has to really kind of force herself to do the hug thing. So,
I can't tell you, and I'm so stupid. I can't just accept the hug like a normal human being. I can't tell you how many people have gone in for a hug, and I give them a good firm handshake, and it's just I see myself
the
doing
Texas
it
way,
and I'm like idiot, idiot, idiot. You know, if it's a guy, it's a little better to just stick out your hand and do a handshake. But I've had these really sweet, nice women that want to give me a big hug, and they come in, and I'm like,
it's because they love you, Mary.
Handshake. Oh my gosh, I'm so stupid when it comes to that stuff. But that's my own deep-seated psychological issues. So back to Mustangs.
So now there's so many different competitions in this, Samantha. There's so many different things you have to do in this particular competition, which we talked about earlier. What's the thing you're most worried about with this particular horse?
Most worried about with this particular horse? I don't know that as far as the classes and the maneuvers and things that we're going to have to do that I'm most concerned about with her. It's just keeping her calm and relaxed. You know, she, like I said before, she just wants to do the right thing, but being calm and relaxed and getting through it smoothly, I think, is going to be my biggest challenge with her. Obstacles themselves, you know, after the first initial, oh my goodness, there's a booger bear over there, she's actually pretty good about, you know, going on through or going over. But she's just a little bit cautious about things, especially when I'm, you know, kind of moving forward. So hopefully I don't lose forward motion, or hopefully I don't gain too much forward motion when I get to the show.
So. With the atmosphere at this event, you might have a lot of forward motion. That might not be a problem at all.
I might have way more.
Yeah, that's true.
Absolutely. So hopefully not too much forward
motion. In the way. So.
Yes.
Well, we wish you the best of luck. It's, I don't know, is there a website for the Mustang Magic?
I don't know if there's a website specifically for the Magic. Okay. I know you can go on to the Mustang Heritage Foundation. I believe they have at least a schedule of the days and times of which, you know, each class will take place.
And when is it again?
But I'm not sure if there's January 19th, 20th, and 21st.
All right.
The third weekend in January.
Sounds good. If you're in the Texas area and want to head over to and that won't be the only thing going on. You'll have a lot to see and do there. So check it out. It's a Mustang Magic competition. You'll get to see Mary and Samantha both there competing against each other with their little ones. So good luck, guys. Thank you, Samantha.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, that sounds like fun. And, you know, I didn't know it was at the same time as the Stockyard. So that's going to be crazy.
Yes.
Everything happens at the same
time.
It's
like
as the
10 million people that go to that.
It is. Yes. And, you know, the funny thing is it's pretty daunting and it's a lot for any horse, let alone a Mustang 4 months out of the wild. But what I've experienced and seen others experience time and time again is their Mustang at home will be kind of, you know, they're like, oh man, I don't know if I'm going to get this horse to this event. I don't know how it's going to go. They're still really scared. And these Mustangs go to that environment. And I think we've talked about this before where it's just so much that Mustang just looks at their person and they're like, you're the only one I know, so I'm going to stick with you. And they just kind of take it in stride. They're perfect.
That's what they say about parades. There's so much going on that it's hard to freak out at any one little thing. So,
and yeah. You can ride in the stock show parade with your Mustang. They have a group, which I plan on doing.
Do they put a fence up first around the audience? Or
I think everyone has a dart gun on hand, just in case.
Just, you know what? The audience just has to carry plastic bags. That'll all go well, I'm sure.
It'll keep them in the middle.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Well, let's take a break for our sponsor, Horseware, talk a little bit about their blankets. And then I thought a song today would be perfect is Only in Texas, because that's where it's all happening in January. And then we're coming back with a bunch more listener questions. We have a bunch more to get to. So if you're up for that, we'll do some more of those when we get back.
They say a good rider can hear his horse speak to him. But a great rider can hear his horse whisper. The years he's given me. Nobility without conceit. Friendship without envy. Beauty without vanity. A loyalty without compromise. I borrowed freedom when we rode. The history of mankind and civilization rode with us. His body took the weight of mine and I was carried through. I can still hear that whisper.
For more information on the complete line of horseware turnouts, including Rambo, Rhino, and Amigo, visit horseware.com or ask your local retailer or online supplier for more information on horseware.com. We'll be right back.
roping, cattle ranching, gate opening, buckle wearing, barbecuing, beer drinking, pig roasting, hay baling, friendly driving, fiddle playing, son of a gun. Double hocking, steer tripping, washer pitching, cow tipping, snake shooting, jukeboxing, honky tonking, haggard listening, church going, W voting proud. Where they're from? Yeah, Texas. Only in Texas. There's pride in the eyes of the ones who wear that brand. Cause it's a whole nother country between the Red and the Rio Grande. Yeah, we got it all, only in Texas. Hauling, bronc busting, bull riding, trail dusting, barrel racing, bulldogging, hat stetching, boots justing, rodeo and wrangler wearing, spur jingling, real cowhand. Beef eating, cattle grazing, two stepping, steer hazing, chip kicking, chili cooking, Lone Star appreciation, pistol packing, deer tracking, Alamo remembering land. Yeah, Texas, only in Texas. There's pride in the eyes of the ones who wear that brand. Cause it's a whole nother country between the Red and the Rio Grande. And we've got it all, only in Texas. Hey, we got it all, y'all, only in Texas.
That was Dan Roberts, Only in Texas. And you can find all of his music at oldbootsmusic.com.
That was a good one. I liked that.
See, Dan Roberts has a lot of good ones, actually. And he lives in Texas. You know, we did an interview with him once. We did a musical episode with him. And he was out with the cattle. They were trying to round up some cattle at the time we were talking. So you could hear mooing in the background the whole time.
How authentic.
I was. It was very authentic, actually. This old Texas cowboy who sings, and we could hear the cows the whole time.
Awesome. You know, I have this new observation deck on my arena, and I get good Wi-Fi out there, and I've gotten outlets and stuff. I'm like, wow, it would be really nice to do the show one morning from there, because I've got a table. But when my baby cows see me, they come to the fence in that particular corner because it's right up next to the pasture, and they're moo at me. I'm like, nah, that might be too much. Too much sound effects.
Well, of course, you're listening to Horses in the Morning. Mary Kitzmiller is here. She is here the second Thursday of every month, and we're brought to you by Horseware. Well, we have some more listener questions for you. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
All right, let's tackle some of these. Katie Kelly, I would love to know how to train my horse to be more forward. She is an apparently go to the Stockyard show. You'll be very forward. She's an Appaloosa, and she's not very responsive off the leg or spur, and I don't want to go the route of bigger spurs or any sort of escalation. We didn't have that problem. You know what?
Question.
The Appaloosa we had was kind of that way, except for when he wasn't. And then it was the exact opposite, if you know what I mean.
So, oh, yes. It's like the gas pedal stuck.
Yes.
And you can't push it down at all. And then when you finally get it to go down, it goes to the floor.
That's right. It's like driving a new car you're not used to. There's a little whiplash involved.
Exactly. So, this is like the mounting block. This is another pretty common problem. And one of the things I see the most that people run into is, I want my horse to trot faster or to trot at all. And they'll use their legs or whatever means they have to get their horse into a trot. And their horse makes it into that gate, and then they keep asking for it. And they end up just kind of in this zone where the horse is sort of trotting, but the rider is having to kill themselves and just keep leg on constantly. I see a lot of people, especially those who ride without spurs, I'll say, push your heels down. And as soon as they do, the horse stops because they've had their heels dug into their rib cage the entire time. And if I tell someone, I've had people say, I'm not putting my leg on my horse. I'm like, you are. I can clearly see you're putting a dent in his side. And it's such a subconscious thing. You don't realize you're doing it. And we're afraid, a lot of us are, and I go through this too. You're afraid to let your horse not do the thing you're wanting to do. So, you know, you say, if I push my heels down or take my leg off in any way, they're going to stop. It's like, let them stop and then show them how to get back to trot again. That's where they're going to learn. But if you're constantly having to keep legging them, or you feel like you got to get bigger spurs, and I've been here, you feel like maybe I need a little crop, and I just, you're constantly trying to nag them into that gait, the quality of the gait's going to go down and down and down, because that horse is going to just learn to live with your leg being on 24/7. And
ding, 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 ding,
exactly.
Thank you.
and okay, people, I've had multi-million-dollar earning trainers say that some horses are dull and heavy. I do not believe this. I believe that all horses have a high degree of sensitivity, some more than others, but it's much more than we think. But they learn, they're very good at learning to put up with stuff. I'll see the same horse that I felt like I had to kick his ribs off, turn his whole body inside out to bite a fly on the top of his tail. I'm like, if that made him, you know, if that tiny little fly leaning on him compelled him to twist around to bite it off his tail, then he feels your leg. He just thinks that he has to live with it. So how do you fix that? Well, again, the magic word is transitions. Transitions will save your life. With my colts, I have this problem with a lot of colts, even colts that are very hot and energetic and fast, is getting them to maintain a gait. So all I hope for when I'm starting with a colt, or if I was starting with a horse that had trouble going forward, is, can I get you there? It doesn't matter if we trot for 20 minutes. I just care, can I get you to the trot? And so I will do what I can to get my horse to the trot. As soon as they make it, I release everything. If they maintain the trot, awesome. If not, fine too. I will let them come back down to whatever gait they feel most natural in, which might be the stop. I have horses that's their favorite gait, is standing still. And that's fine, because guess what I get to do again? It gives me another opportunity to practice getting them to that trot. So I would rather, instead of kicking on my horse an entire session trying to keep them trotting, I'd rather practice getting to the trot hundreds of thousands of times. So what happens is your horse gets rewarded every time he made that effort. So say you have a horse that it's hard to get him to trot, or can, or whatever. It's hard to get him to trot. You ask him to trot, they finally listen to you and say, okay, I'll trot. And you keep kicking on them. They're like, well, that wasn't worth it. You know, why?
Exactly. What incentive? Exactly. You know,
you're just going to keep kicking on me. If you're going to kick on me all day, I might as well walk. You know, yep, let them get there. And, you know, if it's a horse that's really, I've had horses that I could not get out of the walk. So let's say I finally get them into that next gate. I may give them a huge reward. I may let them sit there for 5 minutes. It depends on, you know, the degree of difficulty with the horse. But for sure, when they finally make it to the trot, I release. And if they keep trotting, awesome. If they stop, fine. And then what I'll do is I'll do it again, and then release when they get in the trot, and then I'll do it again, and then release when they get to trot, and again, and again, and again. And I'll do that hundreds of times at a session. Pretty soon, that horse will pick up the trot and kind of stay in the trot. So I'll do that again at all three gates. I'll do it from the stop to the walk to the trot, trot to canter, and then within the gates. Initially, I'll get my horse just to trot, but then I'll say, okay, now can you extend the trot? So that's also, you know, I talk about I call them secret weapons. They're not so secret, but if I have a horse that's difficult to canter, I'll have this problem either with a horse that is really hard to get to move, but I'll also have a problem with a horse that I'm worried about, like a colt. I'm worried about if you get to the canter, you're going to bolt, or maybe you're going to buck. So instead of trying to get them into the canter, I tell myself, I want you to extend the trot as much as you can. I don't care if you can or not. And what happens? So I'll work on extending that trot, bringing that trot up as big as I possibly can. And again, I'll reward them once they hit where I think they've done and made a great effort. I'm going to release. If they slow back down, good. I get to practice it again. So then I'll practice stretching that trot out and getting it as big as I can possibly get it, and then let them come back down. What'll happen after a while, may take one ride, it may take 10 rides, is I'll ask them for this big, stretchy, extended trot. And then I'll have this feeling like it would be so easy just to roll you right into a canter right now. And when I ask just a little bit more, it actually is very easy. The horse just, it's such a natural transition for them to do. They roll right into that canter, and then I can let them come right back down again. And I'll play with just tipping them over the edge of that trot right in the canter and letting them come back down. It's great if you've got a horse that's fearful in the canter. So even if your horse wants to run off in the canter, I'll do this. If you can't get your horse to canter, I'll do this. If your horse canter is pretty good, but it's faster than you want, I'll do this. Just stretch that trot out, tip them right over the edge in the canter, let them come back down. And it's a great way to get your gates working for you a lot better.
Jennifer, anything to add?
There you go. I spent a lot more time over the years teaching riders than training horses. Didn't really do a whole lot of colt starting and that sort of thing. And a succinct way to put it is really it boils down to rider error. The horse is not dull to the aids because he's dull to the aids. He's dull to the aids either because the rider has taught him to be dull to the aids, or the rider is giving him sufficiently conflicting aids. He's just too confused to even try.
Yes.
So, you kind of reflect on what you're doing and simplify it, and then just keep reexamining. Make sure you're doing it right. And if you've asked 100 times and keep getting the wrong answer, you're asking the wrong question. You're just not doing it right. And there you need to get some help with eyes on the ground, or get some good DVDs or videos, or look at some books, or get your best friend across the street to watch you ride.
Or even video yourself. I can't tell you how many times.
Video yourself. There you go.
I can't tell you how many times I swore to someone that I wasn't doing something. Actually, a few years ago when I was training reiners, people told me, you're pulling on them in the stop. You don't pull on them so much. And I swore, I'm not pulling on my horse.
I'm not doing
Watch
that.
Watch a video and my hands go up to my ears. I'm like, oh, so I am. I'm as guilty as anybody else.
You know what? And Jennifer's comment there was directed at me right there. So that was totally directed at me driving my pony right there.
I'm not leaning forward.
No, I'm not doing that. I am not doing that. And of course, when it's husband and wife, then it's, then it's personal. All right, yeah. Mo asked the question. I've tried to get us through many of these we can today, because we always usually get to two or three of them and then nobody else gets their question answered. How about redirecting horses on the trail? For example, my little dude is what I would call appropriately curious, but my friend's horse is always fixating on some random item he thinks is about spooking at. When she redirects his attention elsewhere, all is calm. If she doesn't, there is an inevitable freak out. She can't figure out how to redirect him consistently, though, and it often ends up in a tug of war where she turns his head, he turns back, turn head, turn back, and, usually somebody ends up in a ditch. So what's the scoop there?
That is a great question and a common issue. First, I would probably ask that person how their horse is to ride in the arena. A lot of people will say, oh, my horse is perfect, but I'm sure there's work to be done there. So if your horse has an issue on the trail, I want to make sure my arena work is good, up to par first. That's kind of a given. In a safe environment, I want to make sure my horse is dialed in. If he's amped up in the arena, he's going to be 10 times that on the trail. So I always do my homework. To me, trail riding is an extreme sport. You should do prep work for it. For sure. If you're just only hauling out every 3 months on the trail and then your horse is acting silly, well, that shows you need to work at home. You need to do some stuff in a good training environment. But let's just say that the horse is perfect at home and has these problems on the trail. Again, to me, this is another feet issue. So she mentioned at the end of this about she redirects the horse, which I think perfect. But then the last sentence says, he turns his head, she turns his head, he turns his head, she turns his head. The head is not good enough. You will play tug of war if you're just pulling your horse's head around. It's got to go down to the feet. So what I mean by that is, to me, I like to teach my horse to flex and give their head and neck to the bridle without moving their feet. But I work more consistently on, if I pick up on the rein, it should talk to a foot. So if I pick up my right rein in a certain way, like I draw it back kind of towards my hip, and I tip that horse's nose, I'd like that horse to step their hindquarters over. If I pick up my right rein and I sort of draw my hand up and out, I would like my horse's shoulder to step over. So that's a very basic idea. So if I'm on the trail, let's say I don't have room to get off on my horse and lunge it, which I wouldn't want you to do anyway. I am going, and my horse just gets really upset by something, or they're looking at something off in the distance, I will do something with their feet. Now, again, that doesn't mean lunging them around or running them down the trail and, or, you know, making run backwards. It means I might ask them to step their hip over one step and then put that hip back. Now step your shoulder over. Now side pass over here a couple of steps. Now back softly. There's a lot of stuff you can do with their feet in a very small area. And like with the mounting block, I will keep working on their feet. The feet is where it's at. It's not just their head. So I might ask them to walk forward, stop, back up, move their shoulders around their hindquarters, move their hindquarters around their shoulders. Any combination of those things I find has a better, better chance of getting them to redirect than simply pulling on them. So if I pick up on the rein, I want something to happen in the feet.
All right. Very good.
Yeah. There's something that I do with Nigel that plays into what you just said, in that you talk to his feet. And because I'm primarily an English rider, I kind of come from it from a different point of view. But when we're out on trails, we, for the most part, ride on single track. There's not a lot of room for a lot of work. But what I will do with him when he's got something, especially if it's off in the distance somewhere that's got him way distracted, I will ask him to just simply take a step off of that single track into the brush a little bit. And the act of doing that is, A, I've communicated to him and told his feet to go somewhere else, but he's instantly paying attention to where his feet are. Oh, I better be careful because there's brush here and there's a little limb there. And it works beautifully. Take three steps off of the single track where it's clear into the brush for half a dozen steps and then right back on. He's completely forgotten about the cow he sees off in the distance because he's thinking about where he's going. And it actually works really well for him.
And that kind of leg yielding or two tracking is perfect for trails. You know, sometimes the trails are just really narrow and you just got to get through it, which again, that's why I say work on some stuff at home so you have better chance. But most trails I've been on are wide enough that I could go down that trail. I can keep up with my group without having to bog everyone down while I fix my horse. And I can two track my horse a couple steps left, a couple steps right, or leg yield. You can do shoulder in on the trail and stay on the trail, or haunches it. You could go forward, you could back up. There's a lot of stuff you can do that doesn't involve you needing a ton of space or making everyone stop and wait for you while you get off and lend your horse.
That makes you unpopular at the trailhead. It really does.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And then the other thing I'd like to add to that is, let's say you get your horse listening back to you. The important thing there is to have some sort of release. Don't keep hanging on to them. If you want to keep a short rein to be prepared, totally fine. But put your hands forward. Let them have their face a little bit. And that way, that horse will soon learn where the sweet spot is. If I'm dialed in, I'm listening to my rider's aids, I get relief. That's where I need to live. Buck Brannaman puts it perfectly. He has a little segment where he talks about riding your horse in your rectangle. And, you know, it's essentially means keeping them under your hands in between your legs. And you do that by teaching them to do things like side pass or two track, going forwards, going backwards, moving your shoulders, moving your hips. And when I first start with these colts, my rectangle is quite large. I'm lucky if I can keep them in the arena. But as I develop more control of their feet, the sides of that rectangle close in, you know, smaller and smaller until it's just roughly the size my horse can fit into. And that's where I call the sweet spot. When that horse is living there, I try not to be in their face. I try not to bother them. You know, if they blow out the right side of my rectangle, I side pass them right back in. But when they find that sweet spot, I give them some sort of relief. You don't have to throw the reins away. I know you're on the trail. You don't want to do that. But I make sure I give them some slack. I relax my aids. You can reward them, scratch them, whatever. And I find that when horses learn to live in that spot, all those things that they used to do to us that can get us in trouble, rearing, bucking, bolting, spooking, they just don't happen anymore. It's just not even an issue. I don't know what it is about it, but it all comes down to foot control.
All right, one time for one more. And this kind of ties into what you just answered, but and it's also very general. TJ asks, what aids do you use for what? I know consistency is important, but right now I'm making them up as I go along and I'm running out of ideas. Is there some sort of list out there? Every instructor has one, TJ. I ride dressage, hack out a lot, and do trick training. I will buy this is the part you're going to like. I will buy everything you sell if you could just answer this for me. So I would say answer it as best you can, and then TJ, get out your checkbook, because you have no idea the amount of stuff Mary sells on her website. So.
Well, and she just said I had to answer it, not I had to answer it. Great. So
that's true. She did just say you have to answer this for me. She didn't say you had to have a good answer.
Exactly. Okay. So when I first looked at this question, I read aids as cues for some reason. So I don't know how you would define aids. I'm assuming aids are like leg cues. And
yeah, I'm not sure from what she wrote either what she meant.
I'm going to kind of go with the idea of more like
cues. Pick one.
Like,
it doesn't have to be correct. She said that.
Exactly. So, yep, exactly. So if we're thinking in terms of cues, like I want to be able to use my left leg up on my horse's shoulder to move their shoulder a certain direction. To be honest, half the time I make them up. there are some that are very natural to figure out. But really, you can get your horse to do a behavior and correspond that with any kind of aid or cue that you can imagine. As long as you're consistent, that horse will respond to that aid or cue. So, you know, a really great example, this is a huge misconception in the horse industry, and there's probably going to be a lot of people that get up in arms if I say this, but a lot of natural horsemanship practitioners will say, oh, my program speaks the language of the horse. You know, I talk in horse language. Horses play 37 games with each other. And if you play those games with your horse will think that you're a horse. I'm not going to say what program that's from. And I like the program, but I think it's a misconception to think that if I move myself in a certain way, that horse is going to look at me and go, oh, you dance the dance of my people. And now I will follow you into the sunset. Doesn't really work like that, at least not all of the time. The reason why those programs work or appear to work is because of conditioning. That horse is conditioned to do it through consistency. So, one of the things that I've been accused of doing is when I asked my horse to yield the hindquarters on the ground, I had it drilled into my brain years ago to lean over and look at those hindquarters, like drill my eyes into those hindquarters. And then I would tap the horse with my stick until they moved over and then I'd release. So I still cannot give up that thing that I do with my body language to like lean in towards those hindquarters. So someone called it the crouch and hidden dragon method. So I was taught that, and the reason I was taught that was because, oh, you know, you are positioning yourself. You know, if you look like you really want the horse's legs to move, he's going to think you're the alpha horse and he's going to move his feet. No, horses know we're not horses, and they know we don't speak horse language. You know, they're smarter than that. So why does it work? Well, if every time I lean forward, I tap my horse on the rump and then release when they move forward, that horse is going to learn about the fifth or sixth time that when I lean forward, oh, okay, I better move. So going on that idea, so it doesn't necessarily have to be something that's intuitive or natural or something you think the horse is going to understand right off the bat. I could say banana every day before I back my horse up. And then one day I'm going to say banana and they're going to start walking backwards. So obviously you want to pick aids and cues that make sense. But if you tackle it with the idea of I'm going to be consistent. I'm going to tell my horse, whoa, and then I'm going to stop them. And I'm not going to give them any kind of release or reward until they stop. And then I'm not going to say whoa and then not get a stop. And I'm also not going to ask a stop without saying whoa. And I'm not going to release my horse or reward my horse if they stop off cue. I'm not going to punish them for it. But if you kind of take those general rules into consideration of we stop on the word whoa, and it doesn't have to be the word whoa, it's whatever you want. We stop on the word whoa. You get rewarded for stopping on whoa. You don't get rewarded if I say whoa and you keep going. I will bring you to a stop. Then pretty soon you've created a cue that your horse is going to respond to, if that makes sense.
Very good. Well, thank you so much for answering all of those, Mary. You know, we had an interview yesterday. It's going to be on the Driving Radio show this week. And this woman had an accident in 2009, paralyzed from the neck down. And she just competed at the World Para Driving Championships. She drives her horse in a CDE through obstacles, through dressage, through cones. They actually have to tie the reins to her hands because she can't really move them. But she has learned to communicate with the horse, one, through verbal commands, and two, through her body. She says, I can communicate. I feel I communicate through my mind and my body. And she believes it goes through the reins and to the horse to the point where they came in fifth in the world.
Wow.
And she is not using any aids, but her voice and her emotions, basically. And communicating, you know, to her horse with those things. So when you hear about somebody like that, it's just incredible, right? I mean, the things that you can do, there is the ultimate in not using restrictive or forceful aids in any way and getting a job accomplished.
Well, and I completely believe her in the fact that her body is probably not physically moving in any way. But there's an energy that goes through there that communicates to the horse. I completely believe in that.
She has some use of her shoulders, like she can make her shoulders move a little bit. And she says, you know, because I can move my shoulders a little and I can give energy through my shoulders, which goes down my hands, you know, which she can't use, and then out into the reins. And, you know, it was an incredible story to hear her talk about how that works.
Again, I completely believe it. And I think this is a big problem that people that I teach in clinics have is intention. I think intention plays a huge key because I've seen people. I was working with a kid in his Mustang, and this Mustang kind of had this kid's number. You know, he just was mauling this kid and kind of all over him because he thought he was his best friend and everything. And I was trying to get him to back this horse just by wiggling the rope. And this horse would not do it for this kid. And I could pick up the rope, horse back right up. So I'm trying to figure out how I could get this kid to do it because it looked like he was doing everything right. And so I just finally said, think about him backing up. And that horse immediately started taking steps back. And I think intention is huge because a lot of times when you're trying out something new, you don't have experience with something. You might have a trainer saying, okay, you need to do this and this and this. You know, put your leg here, put your hand here. And the reason people can't make it work is in their mind, they don't believe it's going to work because it might be a new thing they're trying. They've never done it before. Or maybe they've had a lot of problems with their horse and they have this little part in their back of the mind that they don't believe this is actually going to work. But if you change your mind and say, okay, visualize the horse doing it. I know it's all voodoo, hippie, mystical stuff, but it works. You visualize the horse doing it. A lot of times they will figure out what you're asking. And it doesn't always mean, you know, it doesn't always have to come down to your aids or your cues being exactly specific on point. Well, I've gotten a lot of horses that I can just start talking to them. I'm like, no, put your foot here, put your foot here. And they do it, not because they understand English or that much English, but it's because when I say those things, I'm thinking the things. My body is making a ton of minuscule adjustments that I don't understand, but the horses do because their masters are reading that kind of stuff.
Well, now that TJ has to buy everything you sell, where can she do that?
MaryKitzMiller.com. I do need to update and put some new products up there, and we'll have more coming out very soon.
MaryKitzMiller.com is where you're going to find the CDs. Now, what CDs do you have up there now?
I have an Intro to Clicker Training DVD, a Colt Starting DVD, and a DVD on teaching your horse to lay down without any ropes.
All right, very good. And of course, you have all of your Christmassy stuff going to be going up there because you got a new toy, which anybody who follows Mary is going to see that she is obsessed and has been doing nothing but playing with her super duper ultra modern, super techie router. So I've been fascinated seeing what you've been able to do with that too. So I can't wait. This is what you can get me for Christmas, okay? I'm going to make it simple for you, Mary. I just want the Horse Radio Network burned logo with the little horsey guy burned into wood. I want it for my studio.
Cool.
An old barn board would even be better. That'd be perfect.
Oh, I can get you one of those. You just want like a hanging sign?
Oh, wait a minute. You were supposed to do a car door. Can you do car doors with your router?
I can't not unless they're wooden car doors.
I'll take an old barn board then. Can't do the car door. So yeah, I would love that for my studio right here. I'll put it right above my minions.
Perfect. I can do a minion too.
Can you?
I can. I can do anything you can imagine.
Wow, that's very cool. I can't wait to see the kind of things that you come out with. And of course, you'll be able to see them at MaryKitzMiller.com. We also want to thank our advertiser at Horseware. We were talking about extraordinary things, and I'm going to give a plug. And I know I've been plugging this show off and on for the last, because it's one of my favorite podcasts now. It's called Mighty Blue on the Appalachian Trail. It's a guy who at the age of 61 hiked the Appalachian Trail, fat, out of shape when he started, never hiked a day in his life, just went to Georgia and did it. And did all 2,400 miles of it to Maine. Well, he interviewed a lady on this week's episode who, with polio, is paralyzed from her waist down. And with polio, you have attacks, and then it attacks something else in your body, and then you lose that. So she knew that, you know, she's due to have another attack at some point in her life, and that she'll probably lose her arms or whatever, or not make it. And she said, I didn't want to live life thinking what's going to happen next. I wanted to get as much done as I could. So paralyzed, she got these braces that are electronic and super techie, so they help her walk.
And I think I saw something about this.
They had her on, and she hiked the whole 2,400 miles of the Appalachian Trail with these braces. And it was an incredible story. She said, you know, everybody was worried because they thought, what are you going to do if something happens out there? And she said, you know, you're always near a road. You're always close enough to a road you can get help. And she said, there are hospitals all across the eastern United States. So she said, I just knew I could get help if I needed to and go to the hospital, but I was not going to not do it. And she did it. I mean, some incredible stories in this podcast about, you know, he said, well, how did you even pitch your tent? Because apparently that's not as easy as it looks when you're on the trail. And she said, I'd have to take my braces off and crawl around on my butt. And I would pitch my tent that way. So you can imagine the things she went through on this hike. And she did it by herself. For 2,400 miles. So there are some incredible things out there and incredible things people are doing. And you can find that podcast on any podcast player, Mighty Blue on the Appalachian Trail. Really neat stories he has on there. But thank you, Mary. We'll talk to you again next month with some more stuff coming up. And make sure you have all your Christmas stuff ready and give us a couple holiday buying gift ideas for horse people.
Sounds good.
All right. So have them ready. Ready to go. That's your assignment.
Okay.
It's assignment Mary for next month.
Perfect.
And at MaryKitzmiller.com, of course, all the past episodes of her show can be found at horsesinthemorning.com. Just search for Mary Kitzmiller. It'll bring them up. And, you know, we're going to be back tomorrow. It is really bad ads day. So get out and get on Craigslist and look for some really crappy ads. If you go to Mary's section of Texas, you'll find a lot.
Yes. I think we're the king of bad ads. Yeah.
There's quite a few down there. And Florida apparently also has a lot. So, get on there, find them, and send them in to Jennifer@horseradionetwork.com. And you'll be in the running for whatever the prize is this month. I forgot to ask Jennifer exactly what it is, but we'll announce that tomorrow as well. So that's it for today. Thank you, everybody. Take care, and we'll see you all on tomorrow's show. Bye, Mary.
Bye.